with Greg Berg is coming up. And for this portion of WGTD's morning show, I am delighted to be sitting across two gentlemen who have been frequent guests on the morning show, both part of the music faculty of the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, our neighbors to the north. I'm speaking today with Dr. James Kinchin, who is Director of Choral Activities at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside. And Russ Johnson, I forget, are you a doctor?
I am not a doctor.
I'm not a doctor. I'm not a doctor either. I get mistakenly called Dr. Berg sometimes, but yes, so we're masters at what
yes,
we do, however.
Exactly.
Right. So Russ Johnson, who heads up the jazz studies program at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside. And it's not too often. In fact, this may be the very first occasion that I've ever seen the two of you sitting side by side, certainly in the WGTD studios, because it's probably not all that frequent that the two of you are directly collaborating in the way that you are with these performances that are coming up at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, involving a really extraordinary work that will feature the combined forces of the choirs at Parkside and Parkside's renowned jazz ensemble. So, first of all, we welcome both of you back to the morning show.
Thank you, Greg. It's great to be here.
Thank you so much, Greg. Thanks for having us.
Good to have you here. Russ, the last time we talked was just ahead of Jazz Week, and I trust that everybody was able to get to town and that everything went as you planned.
I think most of them are successful, but I think this may have been the most successful. It was very well attended, and the response from both the students and the general public, including, the general public, the members of the Kenosha area, Racine area, were incredibly enthusiastic. So
fantastic.
It was great.
Yeah, so yeah. Glad to hear that. That's absolutely great. And I don't remember, Dr. Kinchin, when's the last time we talked on the morning show? I know it's not been that long ago.
Well, it's not been that long ago, but not this semester. But as we made our run up to performances and the past semester, we've spoken. Yes,
absolutely. So tell us about this collaboration that is about to take place, is taking place. I suspect that collaboration has been the subject of all kinds of time and energy leading up to now. But
yes.
Talk about these two concerts that are coming up in the very, very near future.
Well, the featured work is the Abyssinian Mass by Wynton Marsalis, and most people recognize that name. He's one of the great musical geniuses of our time, and he's also artistic and managing director of jazz at Lincoln Center, and that has him, doing recordings, doing concerts there in residency, doing tours, and all of those kinds of things. So this Mass is the product of the 200th anniversary celebration of Abyssinian Baptist Church, which is a core institution in Harlem.
Huh.
And the 200th anniversary, it was written, composed, commissioned, and composed in 2008. So it was 1808 when this church had its beginnings. It came out of protest. Black parishioners were not being accorded dignity and equity in the worship at First Baptist Church, and they walked out in protest. They happened to have been largely a group of sailors from Ethiopia.
Wow.
And so they founded the church, and the church was named Abyssinian, which, of course, Abyssinia is an old name for Ethiopia.
Ah, okay.
It grew and it became, it flourished, and by the time we get to the 20th century, it's also welcoming people from the Great Migration who are moving to New York. It is anchoring in many ways the Harlem Renaissance, and it produces this young pastor, by the name of Adam Clayton Powell Jr., who goes on to serve 14 terms in the Congress and becomes one of the most powerful congressmen, very outspoken. And so it's got all of that rich history. And to celebrate that history, the pastor at that time, Dr. Calvin O. Butts, decided that what better way to do it than to commission Marsalis to write this mass, and this mass was premiered in 2008, and it's become a staple. So I'm so delighted that Russ liked it as well, and we both, because we've been talking about collaboration, you know, well before that, and so this then this mass becomes sort of the instrument for us making music together. His forces, he does such an incredible job. An incredible job with every aspect of his artistic and his teaching work, and my singer is coming together to do this.
Fantastic! Yeah. It just sounds great. Before we talk about the collaboration, Russ, it would be great for us to hear your take on Mr. Marsalis from one jazz trumpeter to another, just in general his legacy, and then what you can tell us about him as a composer.
Sure. His legacy is yet to be defined. He's still incredibly active in composing and performing at an incredibly high level, 24/7, 365. He's somebody that is deeply, deeply committed to the music, both in its origins and its history, and in pushing the music forward today. I think he's a couple years older than me, but we kind of came up around the same time, and I remember hearing his name. Yeah. I think he's maybe 2 or 3 years older than I am, and I just remember hearing about him. And I went to see his band with his brother Branford in Milwaukee, and it was in some hotel ballroom in Milwaukee in 1986 or 1987 when they were first kind of bursting out of the scene. And I just remember my jaw dropping at his musicianship. He really is the person who created the Jazz at Lincoln Center. The program, which is the only program of its kind in the United States. In Europe, often there are state, city, government, if you will, sponsored performing organizations. And this one is especially unique for jazz, and Winton has a ton of clout. He's an incredible Pulitzer Prize-winning composer. I mean, he's done it all, and so he has tremendous clout both in the jazz world. He's written orchestral music. He has incredible clout there as well. So he was like the perfect person to really create jazz at Lincoln Center, and it is an organization. It's a big band, regularly a 15, 17-piece big band that is a full-time jazz orchestra. Mm-hmm. And they have smaller groups that go out. They have the regular large ensemble, and sometimes they add to that. And it's, I think, undoubtedly the most important organization in the United States as far as pushing the music, giving the music opportunity to be heard in an incredible hall. Really giving an opportunity for the general public to go hear incredible artists. It's almost impossible for a big band. I mean, this is not the 1920s and 30s. There are very few working big bands, and most of them, the musicians are playing for very low fees, and they're doing it because they love the music. And with Lincoln Center, it's a full-time position that is paid well because Winton has procured endowments and grants, and with the help of the Lincoln Center, forces to really have this band that's out on the road. And they, as Dr. Kinchin said, they're touring all the time. He's Winton is an incredible musician, incredible composer, one of the important trumpet players or jazz musicians of the past 50 years, for sure.
Right. And I think in all of that you just said, which is all true, I don't remember if you actually said that for quite some time he was a superb classical trumpeter too, and we have probably 10 or 12 of his recordings on the shelves here. I know at some point he made the decision to relinquish that part of his performance life, but I always admired that about him, that he had both feet in both of those worlds and was superb in both of them.
Yes, world class in both, and has recorded basically all of the major classical trumpet literature at an extremely high level.
I should think that maybe makes a difference in terms of when it comes then to, for instance, composing in general, and in particular composing something like this. It probably doesn't hurt for him to have some so-called classical chops in terms of putting something like this together, because I mean, if you're going to write something for choral forces like yours, you need to have at least some idea about kind of what your world is like. Or is this more of a jazz work just right to its very core?
Well, I would say that in a real sense, stylistically, it's anchored in jazz. The choral piece of it is more sort of a hybrid, and I will explain that. That there are some moments where we're singing and I'm like, guys, this is about as jazz as it gets. And then there are other moments where it's very gospel in style.
Oh.
And that's his way of doing something that will draw in, going back to the 2008 celebration, that will draw in the singers and so forth of the Abyssinian church and have them be a part of that composition. And he does all of that masterfully, and you're absolutely correct to be trained so that he's really sort of mastering all of those expressive elements and to be able to do those in ways that will communicate to anybody, not just the people who did the premiere and the people who toured with it, but to people like us who get the music in hand and go, okay, say, what's this and what's this?
Right.
And to do that, so well, that's amazing.
So is this a mass? I mean, a Kyrie, Gloria, Credo kind of mass? Or is that term used more loosely here?
It's used more loosely. It's not a liturgical mass. And what he does, he sort of, Marsalis, he fashions it based on sort of the general flow and flavor of the Black worship experience.
Hmm. Okay?
And as you go through the form, and particularly for me with my roots in the Black church, as you go through the form of it, you can see all of those different marks in the service, okay, this is when they're getting ready, this is the prayer, this is what this sounds like. And he involves not just the choir in that in many ways. He involves the orchestra as well, the big band as well. There are some moments where they're doing call and response. The first little lick that we do at the beginning of this has not the instruments responding to us, but us responding to the instruments. There's a solo trombone lick, and then and the trombone plays a piece, and then we respond. It's call and response, but he's got the instrument taking the lead in that, which is really an amazing thing.
Wow, very good.
And that harkens back to African tradition, right? That is part of African musical culture.
Yeah. So, Russ, from your point of view as the leader of the jazz ensemble, what has this collaboration felt like for you and more specifically for your musicians? And in what ways does this feel very similar, very organically connected to other things you've done versus a venture that feels quite new?
It is quite new for us, and that is because of, Dr. Kinchin was talking about it, the way the call and response things. And a lot of these, usually when the jazz ensemble plays or a big band plays, you start the tune, we play in pulse the entire time, and it's, this music traditionally in the 1920s was dance music, right? So there's this steady, continuous pulse and everything. And with this, because it is more mass-like, and call and response, like in many places, the musicians that are in the jazz ensemble are not used to playing, playing more rubato or having this, okay, we're just on cue, we're going to go to the next section. And somebody's going to give one little gesture and we're moving on to the next section. And it doesn't necessarily have to be exactly in pulse, right? And that is something that is unfamiliar for most of my musicians. And so it's really been amazing to watch them kind of let go of their preconceived notions of what this should be. Mm. It is definitely it's such a positive learning experience. I'm sure Dr. Kinchin feels that way for the choirs as well, because it's this interaction that we don't often have. And Dr. Kinchin and I have been talking about doing something, and specifically this piece, for the past 4 or 5 years.
Ah.
Yeah, and it's finally come to fruition. But yeah, it's an amazing experience, and there are definitely pieces that are more traditional big band like, where it starts and it starts and stays in pulse, but we also have to do a lot more recitative or rubato or something like that, where it's and And as somebody who plays a lot of small group jazz, that's fairly common. But in a larger context,
right.
it's not very common.
Yeah.
And so, and it's, and honestly, in the best possible way, it's putting some heat on our musicians because not everything is going to be conducted exactly as you would imagine. It's for them to respond and say, okay, here it is, you know.
Well,
so it's really amazing.
And we're feeling our heat on the choral side as well. But it's all a good thing.
Yes.
And people are enjoying it. And this combines two choral entities. There's the University Chorale, which is more traditional college age, but also members of the Master Singers. And so some of those folk are maybe more senior than I am. Okay. and they have really embraced this. And I had real questions about how they were going to take to it. They really embraced it.
And is the style of the singing, I mean, very jazz-like? I mean, and to what extent are you having to remind them this isn't Foray, this isn't Brahms, or is it not written in such a way that they have to be using their voices in completely different ways?
Yeah. Well, yeah, no, it's written in a way that they need to honor the style of the composition by the way they use their voices. And I kind of laughed because I thought, you know, Greg was a fly on the wall in some of my rehearsals. You know, for example, my sopranos, who make this incredibly beautiful sound. And they do these lines that are very, reminiscent of Puccini and Verdi and all of that, right? And so I've got to say to them, okay, this is not opera, so you know, we got to do this differently. You know? And that's a good thing for them, especially those people who are seeing themselves going into performing, because often going into performing doesn't mean that you have a job and you're paid a six-figure salary to do that. You gig, okay?
Right.
And people will want your services to do different styles, and you have to be adaptable to that.
Absolutely.
And so I think it's real educational for them.
Sounds fantastic.
Providing flexibility. You're really, you know, as Dr. Kinchin said, it's if you want to go out in the world and work, you need to have a multitude of skill sets. And so for our students, this is really, it's an incredibly positive experience because they are developing another side of their musical personality or gaining more musical knowledge.
Right. And having fun doing a great piece of music. And I can only imagine just how electrifying this is going to be for the audience who's going to be there. So outline exactly when and where these performances are taking place and what people need to do if they want to attend.
Sunday, 7 p.m. in Bedford Hall on the W. Parkside campus in the Rita, and Monday, same time, 7 p.m. I believe tickets are $10.
Right, $10. And there's a five, and I don't want to go through the whole list because I might miss somebody, but there's a $5 markdown for seniors and
students
in school and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I also want to mention that we will be joined by four really phenomenal soloists, three of whom are our alums.
Ah.
And the other one's not an alum, but somebody who is a Racine native and comes out of the RUSD system. So Tiana Sorensen will sing soprano. Renee Owens is going to be our alto. The tenor will be done by Emmanuel Camacho. And the bass will be sung by Yesu Larte.
Very good.
We're real proud of those folks.
Yeah, of course. And are these two performances going to be essentially identical? I'm kind of guessing. Well, yeah, I mean,
we hope so.
but I mean, the thing about jazz is, what exactly unfolds is not always precisely the same thing.
Right.
Is it not that kind of jazz, however?
Well, I would say that in essence it's going to be the same thing. Obviously, when you get into improv is improv,
right?
You know, and that sort of thing. And you know, with any concert, even when we do the most classical of things, if you do it twice, you know, there are some different energies that are at work in both performances, you know, for better or for worse, you know. So
right.
And the improvisation plays a big role. And so, yes, the performances will be different. I'm actually playing. I don't often play with the jazz ensemble. I'd like to keep my role as an educator. But I'm going to be filling Winton's chair for this. The improvisation will make the two performances, you know, very different, but the structure of the piece will remain the same.
Sure. Sounds like a wonderful delight, a real treat for people to enjoy the Abyssinian Mass of Wynton Marsalis, with the choral and jazz forces of University of Wisconsin-Parkside joining forces in what promises to be a really exciting collaboration. Russ Johnson, James Kinchin, great to talk with both of you about this exciting undertaking at Parkside coming up Sunday and Monday, 7 p.m. Best wishes to you and all of your musicians.
Thank you.
Thank you, Greg.
Thank you.
It's 8:30. You're listening to the morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg, and here is part two. It was 50 years ago today, that is May 5th, 1973, that a gifted Canadian jockey by the name of Ron Turcotte rode Secretariat to a great triumph in the Kentucky Derby. And that was just the first of three amazing victories that would constitute Secretariat's amazing run at the Triple Crown 50 years ago. And one way to not only celebrate this great moment in sports history, but also to learn more about the jockey who was riding Secretariat that day, is to read a new book called The Turcotts: The Remarkable Story of a Horse Racing Dynasty, that tells the story not only of Ron Turcotte, but also of four other Turcotts who followed him, in a sense, onto the racetrack and achieved great success of their own. The story of their triumphs and the tragedies that were also a part of their lives and careers is told in this wonderful book by Curtis Stock, who has been following the sport of horse racing for many, many decades, an award-winning journalist in the field, in fact, a Canadian Horse Racing Hall of Fame inductee. And he has done a marvelous job with this new book of telling the story of this remarkable family. The book is published by Firefly Books, again titled The Turcotts: The Remarkable Story of a Horse Racing Dynasty. Curtis Stock, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thanks, Greg. How are you?
I'm just fine, and I'm so excited to talk with you. And it's just sort of by luck of the draw that it is exactly the 50th anniversary to the day of this triumph at the Kentucky Derby. And, of course, it's we're talking also on the eve of yet another Kentucky Derby. I have to confess, this is a sport about which I don't know all that much. I mean, I know the big names like Secretariat and Citation and some others, but I have never followed this sport very closely. And I want to say at the outset that I found your book so engrossing, even as someone who came to it not knowing a whole lot about this and frankly barely even recognizing the name of Ron Turcotte, I'm sad to say. So your book helps remedy that. And I wonder, did you really consciously write this book for it to appeal to people beyond people who already are fans of horse racing? It sort of feels like you did.
Yeah, absolutely I did. It's a story of triumph and tragedy, but it's a story of five brothers from a lumberjack family from a small impoverished town of Drummond, New Brunswick, which has a population of just 700, and they all went on to such greatness and triumph, led by Ron, the oldest of the five Turcotte jockeys.
Yeah, it's certainly a human story beyond the specifics of horse racing, although I really do appreciate that along the way you also tell us a lot about this sport and in particular about a lot of the particular challenges that are part of becoming a jockey at this level. I wonder if you could tell us about kind of the central event in the very first chapter of the book, which is a devastating fire in which the Turcotte family home burns to the ground. They escape with nothing except the clothes on their back and their precious sewing machine that they were able to rescue. Everything else is gone. And you describe this in riveting detail. It's interesting, though, that you take as much time as you do for this particular event. Why did you think it was, first of all, the place to begin your book? And also, why did you want to spend so much time chronicling this particular event in the Turcotte family's history?
Well, I just think that it shows exactly where they came from and how poor they were. They had no insurance on the home. The father of the family had just canceled the insurance a few days before the fire. He wanted to save some money, and so he canceled the insurance policy, and they were left with nothing.
Mm. You tell us at one point that that the work of lumberjacks was incredibly difficult and dangerous work. At one point you write, death and danger were bedfellows of loggers and their families. All they could do was accept it and push it as far as they could into the back of their minds. It wasn't a matter of if someone was going to get hurt, it was when. I think that helps us understand why Ron Turcotte, one of the 14 children in this family, was so anxious to leave and try to find a different life for himself. Explain what his hopes and dreams were when he headed off to the big city of Toronto.
He wanted to get a better job, but unfortunately they found hardly any work, and they were eating pick worms at golf courses and cemeteries, getting $3 for 1,000 worms. Him and his friend Reg Pelte were both broke. They were going to return home to New Brunswick, but in 1960, the first Saturday of May, and as you say, 50 years ago, he came down the stairs of the boarding house he and Reggie were living in and found his landlord watching the Derby, a race and an event he had never even heard of. And the landlord looked at Ron and said, you know, that's what you should be doing. You got the small stature. You should be doing. And Ron said, what's that? And the landlord said, you should be a jockey. And Ron said, what's a jockey? And the landlord said, little guys in the white pants.
We should mention that Ron had some background with horses. I mean, he may not have had any idea what the Kentucky Derby was, or maybe didn't even know that there was such a thing as horse racing, but he knew a lot about horses. Explain what his background was at that point in time. What had he done with horses before he made this long journey to Toronto?
Well, in the lumberjacks situations in the forest, it was Ron's job to look after the horses. And he got the horses to haul the logs to the logging mill and haul the logs out of the forest into the streams and rivers where they would form part of the logging camps. So while he didn't know anything about thoroughbred racing and had never even heard of the Derby, he knew a lot about horses, and he got along very well with horses. Mm.
So he and his friend Reggie make the trip to Greenwood Raceway, and Reggie gets a job in the kitchen, but Ron gets a job actually working with horses in various ways. And one of the first jobs he gets there is something called a hot walker. I've never heard this term before. Explain what a hot walker does at a place like the Greenwood Raceway.
A hot walker cools off the horses after they've been running either in a race or just in the morning galloping or after works. They walk the horses around to cool them down. And when Ron went to Greenwood to get the job there and then wound up at Woodbine, that was his job, was to cool down the horses and walk them around. And within 2 years, he was Canada's leading rider, and the next year, he was Canada's leading rider again.
Pretty amazing. You tell us that in that two-year journey, another step was when he was brought to a training center, and there his task was to be one of the people that helped to break the yearlings. Explain what that term is and how challenging that particular work is.
It's very challenging. It's to get the horses used to having a saddle on their back and then a human being on their back, because thoroughbreds, of course, are wild, high-tempered animals, and they don't like to have anything on their back. But the job of Ron and the other guys was to get the horses used to having someone on their back.
He proved to be very good at that and ultimately becomes a freelance gallop rider, which is something altogether different. And I suppose that's something that is a little more closely related to the kind of riding that a jockey does when you're a gallop rider.
Yeah. When he went to Winfield Farms and got the job, the trainer there said that, Ron, I can tell you've been on horses before. And Ron said, yeah, it was my job to look after the horses. And he went on and started galloping horses, which was a precursor to him becoming a jockey.
Mm-hmm. When he is hired by one Gordon Huntley, who runs a public stable and really encourages him to seriously pursue becoming a jockey, one of the things Ron is told right away is that he has to get his weight down, and he's already a small guy, a very muscular guy. You tell us at that point he had a 28-inch waist and a 42-inch chest, so the hard work he had done as a lumberjack had left him a very muscular, impressive specimen, but with a very small frame, and yet that frame was going to have to go all the way down from 128 to right around 105 pounds, a weight he had not been since he was 12 years old. And this is one of the themes that comes up repeatedly in your book, the fact that for a jockey at this level, the matter of maintaining weight, reducing weight, maintaining it where it needs to be, is one of the most significant challenges, and it was for Ron and for all of his brothers as well. Tell us more about that.
Well, almost every jockey has to wage the battle of the bulge. They sweat in saunas and steam boxes. They run for miles in rubber suits. They wear layers and layers of clothing, turn up the heat in their cars, and drive for hours. Many use diuretics like Lasix to draw the last ounce of water out of their bodies. Many are bulimic and purge themselves. And as you say, Ron was 125 when he came to the track, and he had to get down to 105. Eves is the youngest of the brothers, that weighed 150 pounds and had to get down to 112.
Well, Ron is able to get his weight down to the point where he is a viable jockey, and as you describe the first races that that he was in, that would be in the year 1961. His first season ultimately consists of 14 mounts with no wins, no second places, no third places. I mean, in other words, it's not a particularly successful start. Tell us what was, in a sense, going wrong, or what is it that Ron Turcott had to learn in order to become a better jockey, which, of course, he ultimately managed to do?
Well, he had to learn everything, really. I mean, one of the first horses that he rode was Whispering Wind. I think it was that his first horse. And the barn had bet on the horse a couple races later, but the horse blew the last turn. It was running on its wrong lead. It was running on its right lead, which means it was going further and further to the outside of the track, and the rest of the field passed him on the inside. So he had to get the horses to learn to change and lead with their left leg around the turns.
You also tell us that one of the main skills that he did not possess at the outset was just something as basic as patience, that he had to learn the right kind of patience. And I suppose that's part of what we're talking about, is the right kind of balance between patience and aggressiveness. And that's something that ultimately he would learn, but of course didn't understand at the outset.
Right. Yeah. Ron was not a very patient person, and but he had to learn that, because horses, you can't just let them run as far and as fast as they can at the start of the race. They have to be rated so that they have something left for the finish line. And it took Ron all of his first year of riding to learn that.
Hmm. Well, by the time he is into his first full year as a jockey, he has a meteoric rise and ends up being Canada's leading rider, winning, you tell us, 180 races in 1962. I mean, there's a couple extraordinary things about that. First of all, from such an unpromising beginning to achieving such great success. But I was also kind of staggered to see that name, the number 180. I mean, that feels like a lot of races. And, of course, he didn't win every race, so he had more races than that. But it sounds like an exhausting gauntlet. Was that typical for the sport at that time?
No, pardon me?
Was that a typical gauntlet for a jockey to be riding that many races over the course of a single season?
No, no. Everybody, as soon as Ron started winning races, everybody wanted him. He was an apprentice, so he got a weight allowance of 7 pounds, and he could ride, and everybody knew he could ride. And so he got on 825 horses in his first full year, and as you say, was Canada's leading rider. And then in 1963, he won 263 races, so he won even more in the second year in Canada, and again was Canada's leading rider. And by that time, he knew, and the other trainers knew, that he was too good for Toronto, and he wound up going into the United States. And in 1964, he won 250 races.
Incredible. One of the things you tell us about Ron Turcotte as he began to enjoy such great success is that for everything that was changing in his life, one of the things that never changed was his humility. Tell us more about Ron Turcotte's humility and whether or not that remained with him even after he achieved the spectacular fame of winning actually more than one triple more than one Kentucky Derby.
Ron was is a very patient person, and he never complained. He was paralyzed from the waist down in a spill in New York in 1978, and he never complained. He doesn't complain to this day. If you ask him if he hurts, if he's in pain, he said that would be complaining, and I don't complain. He said that one of the last lines in the book is Ron saying that every day he thanks God for being able to open his eyes. He's, without question, people I've ever met, and the same is true of the other brothers, too. They're very decent, loyal, and humble human beings.
Mm. Something else you tell us about Ron Turcotte at this point in his career is that he says, and again, this is when he is still a young rider but already achieving great success, every race I ride teaches me something. Can you take us behind what was at least most likely behind those words spoken by Ron Turcotte? Every race I ride teaches me something.
Well, as you were saying, he had to learn a lot, and he had to learn to be patient. Yeah, he would often make mistakes of going wide into the last turn or coming up where there was other horses and getting into a blind box and a blind switch where he had to take the horse up and not being able to ride him as the way he wanted to. Some horses like to come from off the pace. Some horses like to go to the top. He had to learn the difference and how to ride each of those type of horses. There was a lot of things that he had to learn.
And learn them he did. For those of you joining us, we're speaking with Curtis Stock, author of The Turcotts, The Remarkable Story of a Horse Racing Dynasty. It is the story of Ron Turcotte, but also of four of his brothers who also became jockeys. I think Noel is the next one to join him and to become a jockey, and followed by Rudy and Roger thereafter. Just a quick word about the relationship between these brothers, because that is a very intriguing facet of this story, is that, you know, in a sense, they are very much competitors, sometimes in certain points rather heated or tense competitors, but we get a sense that they were brothers first and that there was a really unbroken sense of loyalty and love between them. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, there's no question about that. They all got along very well, and Ron taught Noel how to be a rider, and he taught Rudy how to be a rider. And when Roger came along, he helped set him up. He was he never saw Eves that much because Eves was 20 years younger than Ron, but it was a family that grew up together and stayed together, and as I was saying, Ron taught Noel everything, and he taught Rudy everything, and Rudy went on to be probably even a better rider than Ron. At least that's what Ron will tell you.
Hmm. And we'll talk in just a little bit about some of the trouble that ultimately follows some of the other brothers. It is in 1965 that Ron rides in his first Kentucky Derby. He does not win. I forget. I think he finishes third, maybe. But not long thereafter, he wins the Preakness, and he is really set on a path towards glory. But, of course, nobody could possibly have anticipated the extent of the glory that he would enjoy with a certain horse named Secretariat. First of all, tell us about the horse itself, Secretariat, and what set Secretariat apart, what made him such a special horse.
He was, I think, without question, the greatest horse of all time. He had 21 races, and he lost six, or he won 16 of them, but the races that he lost were not his own fault. He had a temperature of 104 in one of the races and probably should never have run. In the Wood Memorial, he had an abscess on his lip, and that was the race right before the Derby, and Ron couldn't ride him. And then in the Woodward, he wasn't ready to run because Reba Ridge's stablemate, who had won the Derby in the Belmont the year before, couldn't stand up in the slop, and they had Reba Ridge enter in the Woodward, and then they scratched Reba Ridge and put Secretariat in, and Secretariat wasn't ready to run. So the horse is just an amazing horse. And Ron said we never saw the real Secretariat, that when he retired as a three-year-old, that he was still just getting better and better as he was going along.
Right. And so, in other words, he had the potential to have been an undefeated horse. Right. I mean, the very few losses that he had could all be traced to very specific, you know, physical ailments or miscalculations with his human handlers. Well, of course, what Secretariat does go on to do is win racing's Triple Crown in 1973. And I believe, if I remember correctly, it had been quite a few years since a horse had won the Triple Crown. Just how long a wait had it been?
It had been 25 years. Citation had won it in 1948, and then Secretariat came along in 1973.
Mm. And of course, there's a lot of attention already for the Kentucky Derby, and you tell us an extraordinarily large television viewing audience watched Secretariat's great triumph. And of course, he also wins the Preakness, but we should remember, in a sense, the greatest moment of that Triple Crown triumph was what happened at the Belmont. Remind our listeners, or for those listeners who do not know this incredible story, what Secretariat and Ron Turcotte achieved at the Belmont.
Well, they won it by 31 lengths, which is absolutely astronomical. Ron looks back at the top of the lane when he's got the lead and there's no one behind him at all, and the horse just keeps going faster and faster. And I remember Lucien Laurent saying he was just hoping that Ron didn't fall off because he was so far in front, because that was the only way he could possibly lose. But he just kept increasing his lead, and his lead from Sham, who was his main rival, just kept getting bigger and bigger until, as we say, he won by 31 lengths.
You call it in the book beyond anything ever seen in horse racing. In other words, we can point to this as the single greatest, most extraordinary triumph any horse and jockey have ever won in the history of horse racing. Is that still true to this day?
Yeah. The records that Secretariat set 25 years ago have still never been broken. He holds the track record and the world record for the Kentucky Derby. He holds the record still for the Preakness, and he holds the record for the Belmont. So no horse in 50 years has gone as fast as Secretariat did. Mm.
You've already mentioned briefly the sad end to Ron Turcotte's riding career in 1978 when he falls from a horse. Was that during training or was that in a race?
No, that was in a race in Belmont in New York in 1978. The horse to his outside started getting closer and closer to him, and Ron was yelling, "Jeff, Jeff, move away." Jeff being Jeff Fell, who was riding the horse on his outside. And the horse kept coming closer until they clipped heels, and Ron was somersaulted and landed on his back.
Hmm. He is left a paraplegic in that accident. And, of course, one of the things that is most amazing, and we read about it in your book, is his courage in the face of that devastating injury and the sudden end to his career. But that is not where the tragedy of the Turcotte family ends. There are, of course, these other four Turcotte brothers who are also fine jockeys, but three of them, Noel, Rudy, and Roger, all have very serious drinking problems. Can we trace their drinking problems to anything in particular?
Well, they all struggled with, those three in particular struggled with their weight, and they couldn't get their weight down, and if you're not light, then they don't get mounts to ride. And they wound up being hot walkers and cooling off horses instead of being jockeys. They were all limited in the number of mounts they got towards the end of their career, and I guess that was just too much for Noel and Roger to live with.
You describe a really, you know, the sad image of, you know, particularly Roger, I mean, showing up for important events, for important races, for important training sessions, drunk and unable to function. And it's just tragic to think about somebody so gifted who yeah. allowed his own drinking to in a sense, sabotage what should have been great success. I mean, and he achieved some great success, but otherwise his career was completely undone by this issue, as it was with the other two brothers. What did that do to the relationship between the brothers?
Well, I think that they were both, it's too simple to say that they were sad, but they were disappointed, too, that Roger couldn't handle his alcohol, and he started drinking early, and he kept drinking towards right to the end of his career and the end of his life.
So tell us where Ron Turcotte is now.
Ron is in Grand Falls, far from Drummond, where he grew up. He lives in a beautiful house there. The house has one room that's like a museum. It's filled with trophies and saddles and awards and citations and certificates and press clippings. And it's a magnificent house that he has in Grand Falls.
And you tell us his humility and grace is fully intact. I assume that you had the opportunity to sit down extensively with him for the writing of this book.
Yeah, he was, when we were there in New Brunswick, I spent 3 days with him there. There was a knock on the door one evening, and two ladies had driven up from Kentucky just to get Ron's autograph. And he didn't and got a picture of that iconic photo of him winning the Belmont by 31 lengths, and happily signed it for them and talked to the ladies for quite a length.
Hmm. Well, it is an incredible story told very, very well in your book, The Turcotts, the remarkable story of a horse racing dynasty. The book is published by Firefly Books, and it includes quite a number of photographs, including photographs that capture some of the most dramatic moments in the careers of these Turcotte brothers, including, of course, most notably, Ron Turcotte. And Curtis Stock, the author. Curtis Stock, thank you so much for giving the world this really interesting book, and thank you for being my morning show guest. It was great to speak with you.
Well, it was great to be on. Thanks, Greg. I appreciate it.
Monday on the morning show, Anthony Kennedy, who is another recipient of the Brian Albrecht Living Legend Award from the Mary Lou and Arthur F. Mahone Fund. We spoke to yet another recipient, Byron Wright, yesterday on the morning show. We'll talk to Anthony Kennedy on Monday about his long career in public service. That will be Monday's morning show just after 8. Here's our weather forecast for southeastern Wisconsin and northeastern Illinois. Mostly sunny skies today and a high of 74 degrees, a little cooler near the lake. A few clouds rolling in tonight with a low of 49. Looks like cloudy skies with us tomorrow and a good chance of showers tomorrow morning. Saturday's high 70 degrees, a little cooler near the lake. Sunnier on Sunday with a high actually close to 81 degrees. There is a 40% chance of rain on Sunday. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva.